Hello and welcome to the Ecosystemic Futures Podcast, presented by NASA Convergent Aeronautics Solutions Project in collaboration with Shinoshimworks, a global firm helping organizations and nations navigate ecosystemic transformation. As our world is increasingly digital and interconnected, ecosystemic models are reshaping society, industry, economy, and policy, and reframing how we build for resilient futures. Thank you again for joining our fourth season, in which we're examining the ways that dynamic systems of information, incentive, and interaction are reshaping industry. Traditional boundaries and operating norms are being challenged, replaced with ecosystemic models, our new economic engines for the digital era.
Hello, everyone. I'm Marco Annunziata, co-founder of Annunziata and Desai Partners, and today I'm joined by my co-host, Vic Shiam. And our guest today is Captain Alexandra Haggerty. She's a distinguished figure in the maritime industry, having served as master of the hospital ship Africa Mercy and of the USNS. She's an accomplished writer and panelist, frequently contributing to discussions on international maritime affairs. She's a fellow of the Nautical Institute UK, founder of the charity Captains Without Borders, and currently fleet superintendent of the Passion Group, and a lot more. Welcome, Vic, and welcome, Captain Haggerty.
Thank you so much. Thank you for the introduction. It's great to be here today.
It's a great pleasure. Captain, do you want to get us started with a few more words about yourself? I'm sure my introduction did not do justice. So you want to tell us about a bit more about yourself and your experience in the maritime industry?
Oh, yeah, sure. I'm happy to do that. So I started my 20s. I went to New York Maritime College. It was a great opportunity. I did the graduate license program. I finished a three-year course of study in 2.5 years. And then I decided I wanted to sail and work around the world. So I've worked on a plethora of different ships, from drill ships to government vessels, research vessels, hospital ships, container vessels, car carriers. It runs a whole gamut. I've really enjoyed my time working on maritime administration and military sealift command vessels, which are operated by civilian mariners, merchant mariners. And they have a host of diverse different missions that they do. And it's been just really an exciting and interesting career, to say the least. And I never knew where it was going to take me. But after 10 years of sailing, I got my Master Mariner license, unlimited tonnage. So,
are you still an active sailor then?
I still have an active license. And so my license is good for 5 years, and then I have to renew it with different STCW classes, standards of training and certified watchkeeping, and a certain amount of sea time, right? Or you can put your license into hibernation. But there are very few people that receive Master Mariner unlimited tonnage. In 2020, the U.S. Coast Guard quoted only 150 women in the United States out of 20,000 men that had received this license. And out of those 150 women that are actively sailing, I would say maybe only 20 or 30. Many of them are retired or working in consulting or shoreside. And the license gives you a lot of opportunity to work in various workplaces. And it really opens a lot of doors. So I always push young people to go for their highest license if they can and if they want to.
And I think, as you've hinted, Captain, it's an extremely exciting life and career that you've had so far, also extremely challenging. So I'm guessing that in particular in the maritime industry, a career like yours comes with a set of unusual challenges, which I'm also guessing might have an impact on talent retention and talent attraction policies. You want to tell us a bit about this?
So one of the things that I do with Patient Group, I also sit on the U.S. Chamber of Shipping on their board of directors. It's one of the biggest conversations that we're having right now. So the average age of the merchant mariner is around 55, and the COVID pandemic really did not help in any way possible. I was on a vessel myself during the pandemic. And I remember I was chief officer, and we were the first vessel, U.S. vessel, to have COVID on board. And it really changed morale for crew. And a lot of the crew, especially the older crew members, started to ask themselves, is this really the right place for me? I'm stuck on this vessel for months on end. It's very difficult to get home. Some of this was politics and being overseas in foreign countries and dealing with those kinds of issues to try and get crew members home safely and testing for COVID, that it really became quite a challenge to get seafarers to go out to sea and then come back. I think a lot of them hung up their hat and said, I did a good 20 years. I really enjoyed my career. I had a lot of success. There's a lot of success to be made in this career. There's a great opportunity from people from low, middle class and upper class, from all classes, to make a lot of money. If you have the time and the grit and the intensity and integrity to do this job, you can really be successful and give yourself and your family a really wonderful life. It's a wonderful career, but it definitely has its challenges, like COVID. And so a lot of questions now, especially 80% of ship management companies are concerned, where are we going to get our next seafare? Where are we headed? And I just moderated, I'm a sea trade ambassador for sea trade. And I was at the Connecticut Maritime Association conference. I was moderating a discussion with ship owners about how are we going to do crew retention and what are some of the options that are available to get crew to be interested in this industry? Is it bonuses? Is it high-speed Wi-Fi like Starlink? Starlink is now a huge part and a huge technological advancement that never existed before on ships. And, oh, there's so many different things that we have to consider if we want to keep our vessels crewed. And 90% of everything goes by ship. 90% of everything that you see, that you have in your house, that you lay your eyes on, has been on a vessel. That's huge. It's a big industry and it touches everybody.
I read some stat on every ship travel something like almost a distance to the moon and back every year, something like that.
Yes.
Yeah. I think 90% of our stuff makes it through these things where we're having a lot of these moon trips.
Yes, very much so. And it's a very good point. We travel far distances. We'll spend 2 to 4 months at sea and then 2 to 4 months at home. So the average merchant mariner will spend 6 months at sea and 6 months at home. So half of your life is going to be out at sea. And so your coworkers are your best friends. They're also your firefighters. They do cybersecurity. They do training. They do your medical. They help you. They navigate. They run the engine room. They run the stewards department. It's its own little microcosm, its own little bubble. And what's so important to trust each other. And so it's an industry where you really have to build trust in one another and work hard. And it's really like being sent to another planet because you have to rely on each other for everything and be self-sufficient and learn how to fix things and handle complex problems and make really fast, quick decisions. And it's a great industry for someone who can also be a little bit flexible and who loves, I think, problem solving.
I guess you mentioned the skills that are needed and the, I guess, almost like life experience you get from doing this. But you mentioned the question about how do we find the next seafarer? And I'm almost wondering, it seems like a tough sell, right? So what are the big selling points for someone to get into the maritime industry?
Sure. I think it's financial independence is huge, especially when you look at schools and how expensive it is to go to school now and the amount of student debt. You can go to a maritime academy in the United States, or you can start the unlicensed track and not go to school and build your way up just using sea time. And those people are called hawsepipers, and they can start from an oiler and years later end up chief engineer on one of the biggest vessels in the world with lots of time and exams and testing throughout the years and various assessments. And it's a wonderful career for financial independence, for freedom. You can live wherever you want in the world. So when you're off the vessel, you can live on the other side of the world. The company doesn't care. You completely disconnect from your work. There's no emails to be read. There's no projects to work on. When you're off, you're completely free. So it's a great place for people to build themselves up and figure out who they are, maybe travel the world, try new hobbies, save some money to start a family. And then it's financially very lucrative. And I mean, there's people from all over the world that love seafaring. I think 15% of seafarers are from the Ukraine and Russia. Another large portion of seafarers globally are from the Philippines, and as well as India. And people wouldn't do it if it didn't compensate them for their time and their sacrifices.
You mentioned the social, the family aspect of it. So in order for that to be appealing, I'm guessing you need a large and diverse population, right? Otherwise, you're basically stuck seeing the same people every day. I'm wondering, could you give us a sense of the scale of the industry in terms of the workforce size and the economics of it?
Sure. I'd say there's about 1.2 million seafarers worldwide. As I said, the average age of the seafarers is around 55. More than 97% of seafarers are men. It's a very international environment, though. I work with American seafarers that still come from all over the world. They might have a green card and have just moved to the United States from Nigeria, Sri Lanka, Philippines. I really have an international crew, and it's absolutely fantastic and amazing. And I've had great seafarers on board my ships from all over the world, especially when I worked on Mercy ships. I had 450 people on board. Of course, that was also doctors and nurses, but then I also had 60 nationalities on board, which was also very exciting. So I really got to experience people from all walks of life, all backgrounds, all ages, and it was absolutely wonderful.
How do you deal with the you mentioned this, the large number of nationalities. So I guess, what are the policies and things like immigration and laws, and what kind of issues do you run into? And have you seen that changing over time?
Okay. So the International Maritime Organization, which is part of the United Nations, they are the ones that make the rules and regulations for our licenses and how they are to be acquired and what are the STCW requirements and assessments that one has to have to obtain a merchant mariner credential, which we call an MMC, right? And you can start from the unlicensed. So that could be an oiler, a wiper, a QMED qualified member of the engine department, to an engineer, third engineer, second engineer, first engineer, chief engineer, and then captain, first mate, second mate, and third mate. So those are the main positions on board. And then you also have the stewards department. So you first start on working on obtaining that merchant mariner. So you also, each country has different rules, right? And they have their own academies. The International Association of Maritime Universities credits these schools. And so that's where a student can learn navigation or engineering. I believe that there's 63 maritime universities around the world. We have 7 maritime universities in the United States. And once you finish, you do a bachelor's degree, for example, paired with an engine or a deck license, you graduate with a third mate's unlimited tonnage license or a third engineer's unlimited tonnage license. And with working on ships and sea time, then you can move your way up. And it takes, on average, about 10 years to become captain or chief engineer. So it's a long process.
And then I was going to ask the following, Captain Haggerty.
Yes.
You are making it sound, I think, correctly, like a very exciting career choice. And in fact, I was sold when you told me that when you're on holiday, you can really disconnect, that there are no emails to answer. So for me, that's a game changer. So I'm in. But I'm guessing that since the staffing, your talent attraction and retention issues are pervasive across industries. So I'm guessing that even though you're very attractive, very competitive as an industry, you face a very tough competition. What are your toughest competitors in attracting and retaining talent?
A very good question. Thank you for asking. I think right now, it's pay is always going to be on the table for everybody, right? But also having a really good work environment. There are seafarers that stay within their companies for years because they have a wonderful company that they enjoy working for. There's a good work-life culture. The company actually cares about the seafarers. They're not just somebody disconnected from the rest of the world and the company, but they actually know the seafarers by name, and they're more inclusive and more readily seen. With Pesha, for example, we have a magazine that comes out and it has pictures of our seafarers. And for example, I think that a big part of this is getting to younger people. The U.S. Chamber of Shipping and myself, we all agreed we have to go younger. We have to get kids excited and learn about this career when they're younger, when they're learning about what a fireman is or a nurse or a doctor, like to understand, oh, what's a seafarer? I can be an engineer or a ship captain. I never thought about that. And so last week I was in California. I did Bring Your Kids to Work Day, and we had, I don't know, 20, 25 kids. And I was able to get one of my captains to do a live Zoom call using Starlink. And so the kids and the parents and the company were able to take a tour of a ship live, of the engine room and of the bridge. And then I did a little challenge that we had to abandon ship in the office, and they had to get into immersion suits, and the kids were so excited. And I said, oh, you got 2 minutes. I'm going to time you because that's what we do on the ship. And so they thought it was hilarious. And then after, I was like, who wants to be on a ship? And they all said, me. So again, if we can introduce them in this fun, exciting way of what it's like to be on a ship and somehow interact with seafarers, it can really open their minds and expand their minds to all the things that they can do afterwards. And you can, the Nautical Institute, the president, Andre Leguban, he's wonderful. And he said, hey, Captain Alex, the gangway, you don't only walk down the gangway, you can always walk back up the gangway. And I absolutely love that, because in his later years, I think he's in his 70s, he's still piloting ships in Houston. And he did shoreside for a bit and raised kids. And then he's like, I love this. I'm going to go back to sea again.
It's exceptionally good. Let me follow up, if I may, with a sort of a mischievous question, because it comes to my mind every time we discuss issues of workforce shortages or talent retention, because I'm an economist. And so economists like me are responsible for spreading fear that the robots will take all the jobs and everybody will end up unemployed. But when I discuss issues of the difficulty of an industry in attracting talent, I always wonder, where are we actually in a situation where we are kind of forced to move faster towards automation because we don't have enough people? What is happening in the maritime industry?
Oh, yes, we are moving in that direction. And I think it's extremely important to be cognizant of it and not to be afraid of it. I think seafarers and the industry, the maritime industry, is quite conservative in terms of adapting to new technologies. This is the way we've always done it. And slowly, we're introducing new technologies and optimization and on the bridge and the engine room. And it's hard for some of these generations, certain generations, to adapt this technology and be ready for it. And I think a lot of them are in disbelief that there's such a thing as autonomous ships already, and that a lot of countries are moving forward with this. And it's not something to be afraid of, but something to really get involved in and learn as much as you can about it, because it could be a wonderful direction for you to take later on. If you look at countries like Norway, they have the first electric self-driving vessel in the world called Yara Birkeland. And Yara has really made the news worldwide. And now there's other companies that are doing electric self-driving barges in Belgium, in France, in Japan, in China, and the US. I think we have to be open to this. And especially, there's certain jobs where, okay, maybe going down the river, an electric self-driving barge, in the beginning, there will be three levels of autonomy, right? So the first one, you'll have somebody on board. The second one, you'll have somebody in a control center monitoring the vessels. The first control center just opened up in Norway this year. So, I mean, it's happening. And then the third one is the ship completely creates its own algorithms and can drive itself. And if you walk around San Francisco today, you'll see Waymo and you'll see the cars. There's nobody in them and they're driving you around. And they're still on the road. And I think we have to get excited about this. And I'm excited about it. I want to learn as much as possible about it because I think that's where we're headed. And I'm not saying that all jobs are going to be replaced. And I think that humans are interacting and training with technology, right? We used to go to paper charts. Now we're going to electronic charts. And now Admiralty isn't even producing paper charts anymore. So it's a slow adaptation, but I mean, I'm going to Massachusetts Institute of Technology and we're all about technology and making forward leaps and bounds and testing new waters, literally.
With automobiles, you mentioned the autonomy, right? I'm guessing with ships, maybe safety is less of a concern due to the increased separation, but then again, there's probably a lot more shipping is going, there's an increase in it. So I'm wondering if some of the technology you're talking about for connectivity, is that going to help with autonomy being adopted and also things like weather prediction and such? Is it already being used like that?
Oh, yes, definitely. There's a ton of great weather prediction tools and apps and services that are now available. I think Bon Voyage, Insight, Polestar. There's just there's so many out there now that, I mean, they're all competing with each other. And of course, safety is priority across all of these companies. And I think that as we keep monitoring, and then it's also monitoring our fuel and becoming zero emission. And so a lot of these autonomous ships that are being built in Europe and overseas are completely electric. They want to comply with the IMO and their new regulations.
Yeah, I think the electrification is important. I want to go back to something you just said about the competing, let's say, these different apps and these different technologies. Considering the vastness of this, how are standards being enforced? Are there standards? How does regulation work? And when you think about AI and autonomy, everyone has to agree on these things, right? Otherwise, you're going to end up with collisions and the safety issues.
Of course, yes. And a lot of this comes down to flag state. So ships are flagged just like airplanes are flagged to different countries. So that ship has to abide by the country's rules. It has to abide by the IMO, International Maritime Organization, that grants safety of life at sea, SOLAS. There's certain regulations for safety. We also, for U.S. flagged vessels, we follow the Code of Federal Regulations 33 and 42. We all have to memorize this for our Admiralty law classes. And then we also have to consider the U.S. Coast Guard. So in the United States, for example, the U.S. Coast Guard is working with a lot of these new tech companies that want to be creating autonomous vessels or new forms of transportation. I know that there's a ship that's come out from MIT called a Sea Glider. So it flies hydrofoils and literally navigates. It does all three in the water, out of the water. And that's when the Coast Guard gets involved, because if it's going to be classed as a vessel, right, then it's going to be under the U.S. Coast Guard if it's in the United States. And how, what kinds of rules and regulations in the United States are we going to place in terms of autonomy, levels of autonomy, safety standards, and it all has to be approved. And then we also deal with class societies like the American Bureau of Shipping, and we're all working together, and regulators in DC to make everything come together and to embrace this new technology. I understand that the US, especially in defense, has already used autonomous vessels drones and other vehicles, I think it's time for the commercial industry to catch up. And when they do, I think it will also be very lucrative.
I wanted to go back to the other part or the other technological issue you raised, Captain, which was electric and the commitment of the industry to eventually become zero emission. Is the future electrification of the entire maritime fleet? Are there other fuel solutions that can speed up the transition? How should we look? How should we be assessing the transition to zero emission?
I think the IMO has come up with several regulations. You have the carbon intensity indicator regulations that started in 2023. This will measure the efficiency of a ship in transporting goods or passengers in terms of carbon dioxide emissions per ton mile. So ships will be rated from A, most efficient, to E, least efficient, with mandatory requirements for ships rated D to submit a corrective action plan. We always have corrective action plans, CAPs, in place. The other one is going to be the Enhanced Energy Efficiency Existing Ship Index, EEXI, which also comes into force in 2023. Which mandates that the existing ships meet a set minimum energy efficiency standard. And that's going to be based on the ship's design. And it also relates to reductions in carbon intensity. So ships will undergo surveys, and then they will obtain this International Energy Efficiency Certificate to be able to comply. And then lastly, reductions in GHG emissions. The IMO will reduce total annual GHG emissions by at least 50% by 2050 compared to 2008 levels, and to work towards phasing them out entirely by the end of the century. So again, this gets very complicated. It makes ship management companies a little nervous because this can also get quite pricey. And so how do you implement this technology? Smart companies are doing this now and getting ahead of the game.
It is very impressive and highly encouraging. Are there any other fuel sources that are being considered? Are there actions? You were telling me something else which I found interesting pre-recording conversation, which was some of the efforts also done to overhaul and upgrade existing vessels. So I'm curious in the bigger picture or some of the concrete examples of what is happening here.
Sure. So some of the ways that vessels are going green, they're using ammonia, hydrogen, methanol. Our company, Patient Group, we're very proud to be the first company to do hydrogen fueling in the United States. So we do hydrogen fueling for the San Francisco ferries. So these vessels already exist. And more on the way. One of the other things is upcycling. So this is a new word. I've always heard of recycling, but upcycling means that you will take the inside of the vessel, and instead of creating a lot of tons of carbon to create a brand new vessel from scratch, you'll take an old one, take the insides out of an old one, and then put in a new, cleaner, leaner engine. So that's what Pesha did with one of our vessels, and we're very proud of it. It's the first time a company has ever done this. And it's really opening the doors to how we can go green, how we can use older vessels and maybe reinvent the wheel in terms of being cleaner, greener, energy efficient. I mean, now this vessel runs LNG, liquid natural gas. And so we're seeing huge changes. And so it also saves the company money.
As we're nearing the end of our conversation with Captain Haggerty, Vic, do you want to jump back in? I'm sure you have a series of
questions. Yeah, I had a question about hydrogen and some of the other things you mentioned. So on the technology side, it all sounds good, but have you guys encountered any issues with sentiment among the workforce in terms of concerns with hydrogen or with the infrastructure? And how are these kinds of things being measured and prototyped?
I think one of the biggest concerns is there's a lot of learning. I mean, this has only happened in the last, I think, couple of years. I remember taking my first LNG IGF class, and it's still very new for a lot of people and also new for companies, right? So you can get an LNG endorsement on your license. So you have to take a class for this. You have to go through safety standards and assessments. And I think one of the greatest challenges is there's just not enough people that have that knowledge on LNG vessels. And then we need those people, once they finish shipping out, to come shoreside into the office and bring that knowledge to the next generation. And it's going to be challenging. I think we need more training, more people, and it's going to be, some of these fuels are new. We've never worked with them before. And we want to, right? A lot of companies want to, but I think it's the infrastructure can be quite pricey. And anything that's on the water, if you don't own it, is very expensive. So building infrastructure in ports can be quite pricey. Just the property, the piers are expensive. Everything involved on the water is expensive. It's prime real estate. So it's, you got the infrastructure, you got the training challenge, the amount of people is also a challenge. Yeah.
And I wonder if I do see the adoption rate, I guess, in the shipping industry maybe outpacing that in, let's say, aviation, and correct me if I'm wrong on that, but I'm wondering if that ties to your initial comment about how the maritime workforce, it's kind of its own culture, right? And I wonder if social sentiment on land perhaps is maybe more slow to change and maybe more concerned, because you think about aircraft and hydrogen and such, there's some connotations from, you know, years long ago that might be a barrier to adoption, whereas maybe not in the maritime context.
Not in the maritime context, like that shoreside is having a harder time adapting to this technology or more open to it?
I'm hypothesizing that perhaps in the maritime industry, people might be more open because it's its own community almost.
Yes, and you're very right about that. it's its own, we just think of ourselves as different. Even the office people do. Oh, it's the maritime industry. Of course, you're going to pick up the phone at 2 o'clock in the morning and talk to a captain and hear about a vessel. And if people still take care of things, even if it's in the middle of their kid's birthday or something. And it's the maritime industry never sleeps. It's 24 hours a day. And those ships don't just stop working. You just change the people on the ship and it just keep moving. And I think it's having the right company culture is crucial to embracing these technologies. And it's just going to take time. I think that I'm in a company that's very open and proactive to change. They're very entrepreneurial, which is a lot of fun because they work on so many diverse projects. But other companies, they're a little bit more slow to adopt certain technologies. And it can also be a huge cost for them to integrate this. If you're a tug company, but I heard the first electric tug has come to America this year, which is very exciting. And I think the same with these fuels. I know that a lot of maritime people are highly sought after by other industries like the aerospace industry, and they're poached because I think if we look, there's just not as many people training into the industry, graduating with the license, smaller population, lower fertility levels. I think it all starts interacting with one another, and it affects the entire system. I'm in system dynamics right now at MIT, so I can't stop thinking about how everything's related.
Marco?
Yes, Captain, this is a fascinating conversation. Before we let you go, any final remarks, anything that we didn't have a chance to cover but you think the audience should absolutely hear?
I think for them, this is a new industry. Maybe some of them have not experienced before. And I think it's a wonderful place if you have kids or family or friends to go and look at these maritime academies, to think about it, to learn more about the shipping industry. There's a great book by George Rose, 90% of Everything, read about our industry and the Maritime Executive, Tradewinds, G Captain. Get to be more familiar with us. You'll realize there's thousands of opportunities, and it's very exciting. A lot of the maritime hubs are in Hong Kong and London and Singapore and Norway and New York. And there's just, it's a very fun, exciting industry where, you know, at MIT, we now call it blue tech. And it's, instead of fintech, it's blue tech. And I think it's going to be the next new wave. I do.
Outstanding invitation to learn more about the industry that I'm hoping a lot of the people in our audience will pick up on. And we normally finish this podcast with us, the hosts, just offering our instinctive fresh takeaways from the conversation. I'll go first and then turn it over to Vic. For me, really, what's been eye-opening has been this overview of the maritime industry as an industry which, one, is crucial to our global economy. We all realize it when things go wrong on shipping routes, but the number you gave us, that essentially 90% of everything that goes through our hands has been on a ship at some point, I think is a stunning reminder of how crucial the industry is to economic growth, and also an industry which clearly is both crucial to sustainability efforts, but also spearheading the move towards the adoption of new technologies, whether it's to reduce emissions, to adopt automation and autonomous shipping in this case, in order to make the industry also more, even more attractive to human talent. So definitely an industry which even though is one of the oldest on the book and still incredibly crucial to economic growth, a very exciting industry in terms of the intersection of old and eternal challenges with the cutting-edge new technologies. So for me, the main takeaway is this is really an industry to watch a lot more closely from all perspectives. Vic, let me turn it over to you.
Sure, Marco. I agree with everything you just said, but I would like to add one thing, I guess, to consider, and that is, given the, or should I say, the uniqueness of the maritime industry in that it's almost its own ecosystem in some ways, but it interacts with so many parts of society, it may be an opportunity as we're going into all these new societal models, whether it's economic or it's in the social structures or it's technology adoption, it might actually provide a platform for experimenting on new models that might not work on land in terms of viability options, but ways to get things done without barriers, perhaps, and then learning from that and applying it to us land dwellers.
That is an exceptional point, Vic, really an exceptional point and a perfect point to end on. So huge thanks to my co-host, Vic Sheehan of NASA. Huge thanks to our guest, Captain Alexandra Hegarty. And thanks to all of you for following us. And of course, if you enjoyed this conversation, we welcome you to join us for more Ecosystemic Futures podcasts on the Applecast or your favorite podcast source, and at shoshinworks.com. Thank you, everybody.
Thanks, everyone, for joining us today. And please do check out this season's new episodes as we explore the convergence of innovation, technology, and refactored business models, and how this convergence is reshaping industry and what it means for our ecosystemic futures. Follow us and subscribe on Apple Podcasts or your favorite place to access podcasts. And you can always learn more at shoshinworks.com.